For I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you. That the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took a loaf of bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, This is my body that is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he took the cup also after supper, saying, This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup in an unworthy manner will be answerable for the body and blood of the Lord. Examine yourselves, and only then eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For all who eat and drink without discerning the body, eat and drink judgment against themselves. Most of you here this morning are well acquainted with that passage. Some of you, no doubt, have heard it read perhaps 1,000 times. If, however, to your ears it's not familiar, the best way of introducing it to you is by saying it is a portion of the New Testament scriptures frequently read in connection with the eating of a meal, a sacred meal that Jesus Christ himself established for his people, the very meal that is set before us this morning. Throughout the centuries, it has been variously referred to as the Eucharist, the Sacrament of Communion, the Ordinance of the Lord's Supper. Very often around here, we refer to it simply as the Lord's Table, as Paul does in 1 Corinthians 10. Along with it, we frequently read this passage because it reminds us that one of the great intentions of this meal is the refocusing of our attention. It calls us, for example, to refocus our attention upon the past, most specifically on an event from the past. We do this, says Jesus, in remembrance of him. But what of him in particular are we to remember? Paul tells us, For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death. In this sense, the Lord's Supper refocuses our attention upon the past. But it also refocuses our attention upon the present by calling us, every time we partake of it, to give fresh consideration to the oneness of the body of Christ. Examine yourselves, and only then eat of the bread and drink of the cup, for all who eat and drink without discerning the body. That's not our body. As though the purpose of the Lord's Supper is that we all turn in severe introspection, cover under, open up every possible closet in our lives to see if there is something there unworthy. No, for all who eat and drink without discerning the body, that is the body of Christ, the unity of the body of Christ, eat and drink judgment against themselves. One of the great benefits, beloved, of the Lord's Supper, when it's observed rightly, is that it prompts us to a fresh, present estimation of the one body of Christ. It also, however, helps us to focus our attention upon the future. The Lord's Supper reminds us that Christ's death is not the end, but the beginning of the end. The Lord's Supper is not a funeral service, a sentimental memorial of Christ's tragic death. Rather, it is a living restatement of what that death accomplished, including a vital dimension of our salvation that we still eagerly anticipate. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. This morning, my friends, with the table of Jesus Christ set before us, we remind ourselves not only of his death, burial, and resurrection, we remind ourselves of his coming again. We remind ourselves of the hope that awaits us, the salvation purchased for us by Jesus Christ that is yet to be consummated. We remind ourselves of a coming day when, unlike the present, all of our labors will be full of pleasure and meaning. We remind ourselves of a coming day when, unlike the present, our minds and bodies will be delivered from all weakness. We remind ourselves of a coming day when, unlike the present, our hearts will be freed from all of the undertows of remaining sin. We remind ourselves of a coming day when, unlike the present, even the best and most intimate of our relationships will be intensified in the context of perfect love. We remind ourselves of a coming day when, unlike the present, our relationship with the living God will thrive in joyful fellowship without any threat of interruption ever again. I'm absolutely convinced this morning, dear friends, that there are times in each of our lives when the forward-looking emphasis of the Lord's Supper is the most precious benefit we can glean from it. This past Thursday morning, a couple of us met together for prayer. And as we sat down to begin, Randy Eikenberry said, before we pray, may I read something to you? We said, sure. And this is what he read. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. He put his Bible down and said, with a hint of a tear in his voice, I needed to hear that today. So do each one of us. It must be so, beloved, because throughout the whole of the Bible, the inspired writers repeatedly set before us compelling visions of the future. It is though the Spirit of God knows that, like a traveler following the North Star, our passionate attachment to the future will secure a trajectory of life that will see us to the end without making shipwreck of our faith along the way by veering into the seductive waters of idolatry. We live in a fallen world, and as such, my friends, we ought never to be surprised that every single day of our lives is characterized by some imperfection, some disappointment, some unmet expectation, a frustrated ambition, broken friendships, shattered families, sickly bodies, premature deaths, unrealized relationships, fulfilled desires, dashed dreams, sufferings and persecutions. Well, you see, knowing our susceptibilities as he does all too well, that ancient serpent, disguised as an angel of light, comes to us holding out a golden cup. The promise of absolute fulfillment in this fallen world. He seeks to beguile us away from God and the gospel by setting before us all the alluring idolatries of our fallen culture. Things like professional success and political power and passionate sex. And of course, the most effective idol of all, economic prosperity. If power and success and sex has slain their thousands, the lust for economic prosperity has slain its tens of thousands. This is the whore that we discovered last week. Clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations. Her name, Babylon the Great, the mother of whores. So, friends, how do we escape the allure of this idolatry? Admittedly, we're certainly not beyond temptability, are we? How do we, as Christians living presently in Babylonian captivity, avoid succumbing to the universal influence and pressure of idolatry? Well, it was a question, you see, haunting the mind of the Apostle John, who at the writing of the Revelation, if you recall, was in exile on the penal colony of Patmos and thus severed from direct contact with the Asia Minor churches. At the same time, mindful that the intrusion of idolatry had already begun to evidence itself in the hearts of Christians and their congregations. How does he seek to counteract this influence? By doing what the table does. By refocusing our attention on the future. He does this positively, as we will see in coming weeks, by providing us with a vision of the compelling beauties of the New Jerusalem, chapters 21 and 22. People in the ancient world, you must appreciate, believed that ideal human community expressed itself in cities. This idea of moving out to the wilderness, away from everybody, is not the viewpoint of the people of the Bible. The ancients that we read about in the Bible, they believed that you did not have true human life apart from community, expressed most in the ideal in cities. Therefore, if as Christians we are expected to disassociate ourselves from Babylon and all of her corrupting influences, Christians would need an alternative. Another city to which to belong, a greater attraction for their affections. The New Jerusalem is that greater attraction, God's alternative city. Consider the contrasts. Babylon is the whore with whom the kings of the earth fornicate. The New Jerusalem is the chaste bride of the Lamb. Babylon is intoxicated on the blood of God's people. The New Jerusalem contains the tree of life for the healing of the nations. Babylon is characterized by corruption and deception. The nations walk by the light of the New Jerusalem. Babylon's splendor comes from exploiting her empire. The splendor of the New Jerusalem is nothing less than the glory of God. The wine of Babylon makes the nations drunk, but running through the middle of the New Jerusalem is the water that gives life. How does John attempt to counteract the pervasive influence of Babylon? By refocusing our attention upon the future, by setting before us an infinitely greater attraction, an infinitely greater alternative, the compelling vision of God's alternative city, the New Jerusalem. But this is not all that John does to keep us from the allure of Babylon, this culture of fallen humanity and idolatrous defiance against God. In fact, my friends, before John ever articulates the positive, he first very graphically lays out the negative. That is, the portrait of Babylon's demise. It comprises the bulk of chapters 17, 18, and 19. And though unspoken, it does force us to ask a question of ourselves, the obvious question, why would we ever give ourselves to something we know will come to such a miserable end? Babylon's destiny is not life and fulfillment, though she promises it. How did we state it last Lord's Day? Though seductive in appearance, she is repulsive in reality. Her destiny is doom. Here, in verses 1 through 6, the demise of this great prostitute is introduced. We considered it last Lord's Day. Now, in verses 7 through 18, the demise of the great prostitute is explained. We'll unfold it in two stages over two Sundays. It begins with the destruction of the prostitute's cohort. Verses 7 through 14, that's for this morning. Followed then by the actual destruction of the great prostitute herself, 15 through 18. That's for next time. So let's observe the destruction of the prostitute's cohort, her partner. It transpires for us in two paragraphs. In verses 7 and 8, this destruction is promised. In verses 9 to 14, this destruction is performed. Now, do you recall how verse 6 concludes? When I saw her, that is, the great whore, I was greatly amazed. Why amazed? Because what he had seen was something other than what he had expected. Remember verse 1? What does the angel say to John? Come, I will show you the judgment of the great whore. But after this forthcoming introduction to the great prostitute, John is filled with amazement. It's a word that suggests a blend of confusion and fear. Confusion because he had expected to see her writhing in judgment, not at all in her seductive beauty. fear because he had expected to see her defeated, not as she is here, drunk on the blood of the Christians. And so in confusion and in fear, he wonders, what kind of ominous enemy is this? How can Christians endure her seductive powers, given the fact that the entire world is in love with her? And beyond that, she doesn't appear alone. In verse 3, do you remember? John sees her riding the beast. That seemingly all-powerful beast that continually seeks the violent destruction of God's people. This amazement then, friends, is not admiration. It's horrified astonishment, confusion, and fear, for which John receives an ever so gentle rebuke. But the angel said to me, "Why are you so amazed? You ought not to be confused or afraid of anything, John. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her." Now, friends, this is very interesting. John was told that he would see the judgment of the great prostitute. Here, however, suddenly the attention of the angel is turned to include the beast, to concern the beast. In fact, at least in the rest of this chapter, more space is actually given to the judgment of the beast than to the whore. So what's going on there? Is this angel just kind of flighty? Erratic? Easily distracted? Or maybe he's suddenly struck with a bright idea. Let's do two judgments for the price of one. After all, we'll get to the end a whole lot quicker if I just go ahead and record the judgment of the whore and the judgment of the beast at the same time. No, that's not what's going on here. The angel unites these judgments because there is an inseparable relationship between the beast and this woman. The woman rides the beast, remember? They exist in a symbiotic relationship. That is, they share an association that exists for the mutual advantage of each. They live off of each other, at least for a while. You'll notice here that the angel does not refer to two mysteries, the mystery of the woman and the mystery of the beast, but only to one mystery that includes both figures. It's indicative of how tightly bound together they are. And so he begins with the beast, the reason why we'll talk about next time. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. Now keep reading, friends, because at the end of the verse, a very similar expression is used to speak once again of the beast. And the inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will be amazed when they see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. Let me remind you of something, friends. This is not an expression the beast freely uses to describe himself. It's the angel's expression foisted upon the beast, by which he labels the beast, by which he marks out the beast. In this case, by which he marks the beast. You say, well, how so? What expression is used repeatedly throughout the Revelation to identify God? The one who is, the one who was, and is to come. It's an expression of that unique quality of God's godhood that so emphatically distinguishes him from every other thing and every other person. His eternality. He's the God of three tenses. The one who was and is to come. The beast, on the other hand, it was and is not and is to come. On the surface of things, a cheap imitation of God, maybe, but upon clearer inspection, not God, by a long shot. While it is true that this beast will experience something of a second coming. It is to come. It emerges out of the bottomless pit, suggesting the satanic source of its power. Moreover, you'll notice that its coming results in its own eternal condemnation. It will go to destruction. And right there, you see, is the promise of its demise. So yes, in a manner of speaking, this beast is similar to God. The beast was. And yes, the beast is similar to God in a manner of speaking in that it is to come. But if your mind is in any way like mine, your attention has been drawn to the one particular aspect of the beast's existence that is most obviously unlike God's. Twice in one verse, the angel says of the beast, "It is not." What is all of this? The play on these three tenses was, is not, is to come, provides us with a three-stage history of the beast from its beginning to end. In other words, there was an expression of the beast's existence that was true in the past, not true in the present, but that will once again be true in the future. So what does all of this mean? What is this beast? Do you remember from chapter 13? The beast is the image bearer of the great red dragon. The beast is the incarnation, the visible expression of the dragon. So what's the history of the dragon from beginning to end? It too is a three-stage history. Now keep your finger here and turn to chapter 20. The parallel we are about to see, dear friends, provides such help to understand what we're looking at in chapter 17. Chapter 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan. We can stop right there. What does that imply? He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan. What does this imply? That the dragon had existed in the past. That he was. That he had existed prior to this time. And as we will see, that he experienced a measure of freedom that is now about to end. But keep reading. And bound him for 1,000 years. And threw him into the pit and locked and sealed it over him so that he would deceive the nations no more until the 1,000 years were ended. The dragon is locked up in the pit. It's the very same word used back in chapter 17. In other words, he was. He was not. Keep reading. After that, he must be let out for a little while. Let out to do what? Verse 7. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and he will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, in order to gather them for battle. They are as numerous as the sands of the sea. In other words, he is to come. He was. He is not. He is to come. A coming that will seek the final extermination of the Christian church. But in great irony, it is this coming that results in his own eternal destruction. Verse 9. They marched up over the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Now you see, friends, here is the three-stage history of Satan, the great dragon. He was, he is not, he is to come. He was. There was a time when Satan possessed a nearly unchallenged power over the human race. All, of course, under the sovereign providence of God. But as we learn back in chapter 12, the cross of Jesus Christ defeated Satan. And from that point forward, his power of influence was severely reduced. In the imagery here of Revelation 20, he has been bound in the pit for 1,000 years. He was, he is not. Now, does this mean that Satan is altogether out of commission? Not hardly, but his malevolent activity has been severely curtailed. How so? The text is very plain, verse 3. He was thrown into a pit, locked, sealed shut, so that, there's the purpose for this. What does this being bound mean? So that he would deceive the nations no more. What does that mean? That he won't deceive the nations anymore? Well, if we allow John to interpret John, this deceiving of the nations refers to the rallying of the nations together for the intended purpose of destroying God's people. Look again at verse 7. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison, that is, the pit. He will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. Why? Here's the purpose statement. In order to gather them for battle. He can now deceive them so as to gather them for battle. They are as numerous as the sands of the sea. To battle whom? They marched up over the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints, the beloved city. It is in this sense, you see, that the dragon was, is presently not, and is to come, ultimately to his own description. It's to his own destruction. It's the history of the great red dragon. Now, friends, have you begun to connect the dots with chapter 17? The history of the dragon and the history of his incarnation, the beast, are parallel. In fact, these two passages refer to the same events, but respectively from the vantage point of the beast and the dragon. In the past, there was a time, John 17, when the beast was. When the violent power of totalitarian regimes persecuted the people of God nearly to the point of extinction. We can think of Egypt and Babylon, and the Seleucid dynasty under Antiochus Epiphanes. Presently, it is a time when the beast is not. That is, while the beast does exist and exercise its persecuting influence, its powers are restrained. Not able to marshal the peoples of the world so as to destroy the church of Jesus Christ. In the future, however, it will come forth again to do this very thing. In the providence of God, the beast, as in days of old, will rise with what appears to be unimpeded power to destroy the Christian church. Now, of course, as you well know, during the time the book of Revelation was written, Rome was persecuting the Asia Minor churches. And of course, as you well know, even at this present moment, the beast in its various forms persecutes the people of God. That having been acknowledged, it is nevertheless a persecution that is restrained in contrast to the coming day when the beast will come forth bearing the full power of the dragon to annihilate the people of God. We've already seen this, beloved, in the Revelation over and over again. And what about the unbelievers at this time? Verse 8 in chapter 17. And the inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, they will be amazed when they see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This amazement is not the amazement of confusion and fear. This amazement is the amazement of admiration. After all, they've been deceived, don't forget. But their admiration will quickly turn into dread because here, as it has been promised, the second coming of the beast, the parousia of the beast, will end in its own destruction. Now, let's watch it unfold. Let's see this destruction performed. Verse 9. This calls for a mind that has wisdom. The seven heads... What? The seven heads? What are the seven heads? Well, they're the seven heads that were seen to be on the beast. Verse 7. And there were also 10 horns, weren't there? We'll get to them in verse 12. For now, the meaning of the seven heads. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. Also, they are seven kings, of whom five have fallen, one is living, and the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain only a little while. Now the angel explains to John that these seven heads are seven mountains. And of course, if we read this literalistically, people quickly conclude, well, this is obviously a reference to Rome. After all, Rome was known in the ancient world as the city on seven hills. But these are not hills, these are mountains. More to the point, friends, this is apocalyptic, a message communicated via signs and symbols. You say, but Art, I don't like this because this leaves us with a method of interpretation that is too subjective. No, it doesn't, friends. We have the interpretive controls of the Old Testament. And what do we discover there? That in the prophetic literature of the Old Testament, mountains were frequently used as symbols of great and powerful empires. We see this in Daniel, in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, in Zechariah. In fact, friends, in the book of Jeremiah, God uses this language to speak of the Babylonian Empire. In Jeremiah 51, God says, I am against you, O destroying mountain that destroys the earth. I will make you a burned out mountain. The seven heads of the beast on which the woman sits are seven mountains, great and powerful empires. But of course, the same symbol in Apocalyptic can have multiple reference, as is the case here. Also, they are seven kings. What's in view here, as the angel explains the heads of this beast, is seven empires and seven kings. Seven empires and seven kings. But at this point, friends, again, we have to pause for a moment to be mindful of a potential pitfall. Were we to divorce this passage from the rest of the Revelation, we would be inclined to read these numbers literally and conclude that what we have here is a one-to-one correlation with an actual series of seven specific kings and kingdoms. Of course, at that point, we have to acknowledge, as you read the literature, no one can come to any kind of agreement about who these seven kings or kingdoms are. That's because they're going about this thing absolutely backwards. I ask you, my friends, how has John used numbers in every other place? This is apocalyptic. I'm gonna say that to you, friends, until you lay me in the grave, I'm afraid. How has John used numbers in every other place? Not literally, but for their symbolic significance. 24 elders. 144,000 sealed. The dimensions of the New Jerusalem, 12,000 times 12,000 times 12,000 times 12,000. 12 gates, 12 foundation stones, tree of life bearing 12 kinds of fruit. And what about all the sevens? Seven churches, because there were only seven churches in Asia Minor? No, there weren't. There were more. Seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls, seven angels, seven stars, seven thunders. In fact, friends, if we cut Revelation 17 out of our Bible, John uses sevens 45 times throughout the Revelation, all clearly in figuratively expressions. Seven indicating completeness or wholeness, in much the same way we refer to sailing the seven seas, all the seas of the world. I don't think there's any good reason here to suddenly regard this seven in a way that is contrary to all the others. The seven mountains and kings represent then various expressions of persecuting power from totalitarian governments that span the totality of human history. Various expressions of the persecuting power of totalitarian governments throughout all of human history. The various heads of the beast. Now, literally, how many of these totalitarian governments have there been that have persecuted the people of God? I have no idea. Maybe 1,000. But regardless of how many there would have been literally, John still would have used the number 7. That's what he means when he uses the number 7. You say, but then what is he getting at in verse 10 when he says, of whom 5 have fallen? He wants us to get a sense of how far we stand from the full conclusion of this oppressive power. In other words, the beast's time is closer to its end than its beginning. 5 of the 7 have already fallen. And yet the beast is still alive, as evidenced by the fact that one head is contemporary. One is living. One exists now. It represents all the manifestations of the beast that exist during the time between the two comings of Jesus Christ. Now, I don't want to confuse you, friends, but this, I think, is parallel to the description of the beast in the previous paragraph. Remember, twice we read that he was, is not, is to come. Was, is not, is to come. The epoch referred to as the time in which he was is right here, the epoch of the 5 kings who are fallen. The epoch referred to as the time in which he is not is the present epoch of the 6th king, this time during which the beast is unable to rally the world to exterminate God's people. The epoch referred to as the time in which he will come is the epoch of the 7th king about whom John now says, and the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain only a little while. What does this mean for us, practically speaking? It means that the Church of Jesus Christ must persevere, not only under the present pressure of the 6th king, but also under that of the 7th, which will prove to be much more severe. You say, why more severe? Because in a very real sense, beloved, the 7th king is not merely one expression of the beast, another expression of the beast, one of its heads. It is, as you will see here now, the fullness of the beast itself. If you would allow me to use language from another portion of the New Testament, this is not an antichrist among many antichrists. It is the Antichrist. The 7th king, he says, is to come. The 7th king is to come. He is to come. In the prior paragraph, who, twice in one verse, was said to be yet to come? The beast. Verse 11. As for the beast, remember that beast we talked about in the prior paragraph? As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction. Now, why is this 7th king referred to as an 8th? We learned in chapter 13 that 666 is the number of the beast. What you may not be aware of, beloved, is that the number 888 was used in early Christian literature as a reference to Jesus Christ. Why eights? Christ was crucified on the sixth day, rested in the tomb on the seventh day, and rose from the dead on the eighth day. Eight, then, becoming a Christian symbol of recreation, life from the dead. Here, this beast, who was and is not, appears again in a kind of parody of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Only this here is not the latest in a string of antichrists. This is the antichrist, the beast itself, the fullness of satanic power determined to exterminate God's people. And yet, this eighth is still one of the seven, in that the angel wants us to know that its coming again is not a manifestation of recreated life, as was the case with Jesus Christ, just the final, albeit ultimate, expression of that old seven-headed monster that had been defeated by Jesus Christ on the cross. And his reign will prove to be short-lived, he says in verse 10, only a little while, because just as it was stated earlier, this beast is headed for the lake of fire. This beast is headed for destruction. So it goes with the heads. And what about the horns? Verse 12, and the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings, not a literal 10. From which people have developed the idea that this represents the European common market. You see the European common market here? It's the only verse you can get the European common market. Books have been written on the European common market. Not a literal 10, friends. But the idea is a full complement of earthly power in league with the beast. These very same kings referred to in verse 2 and verse 18 as the kings of the earth. Let John interpret John. Full complement of earthly power now in league with the beast. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. Notice, beloved, for a very brief period of time, 1 hour, the smallest measurement of time in the ancient world. These are united in yielding their power and authority to the beast. They don't merely reign with the beast, they submit to its authority. And you'll note, they are clearly of one mind and purpose. The text says they're united. Why united? The world's kings united with the beast? Why united? The basis of their fellowship? They share a common interest, verse 14. They will make war on the Lamb. It reminds me, beloved, of Pontius Pilate and Herod, who hated each other until their mutual desire to be rid of Jesus Christ became the basis of a wonderful friendship. That's what this is. United together, all worldly power for the purpose of destroying the Lamb and His people. We've seen it many times. Do you remember? Go back to chapter 11. Chapter 11, if you recall, speaks of the witnessing ministry of the church. And the great power that God gives to the church, that the gospel might prevail. But when we come to verse 7, that time for witness has come to its end. Verse 7 says, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the bottomless pit, you hear that language? Will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. Look at chapter 13. Verse 1, and I saw the beast rising out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. Same guy. Look at verse 7. it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. Chapter 16, verse 12. This was not so long ago. Remember the sixth bowl judgment? Verse 12, the angel poured his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up in order to prepare the way for the kings of the east. Remember this great setup on the part of God? And I saw three foul spirits like frogs coming from the mouth of the dragon, from the mouth of the beast, from the mouth of the false prophet. These are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world. Why? To assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Verse 16, they assemble them at a place in Hebrew that is called Armageddon. There to destroy God and His people. Chapter 19, verse 19. Let John interpret John. Okay? Burn the books. Just read the Revelation over and over again, friends. It interprets itself. Verse 19. Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against the rider on the horse, that is the Lamb, and against his army. Now back to chapter 17. You see what this is? These are all camera shots of the same event taken from various angles, but the storyline they tell is consistent. It is the last battle when the final and full forces of evil, now restrained, are released to work their violence in its greatest degree against the people of God. But as old Luther said, his rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. Look at it. And the Lamb will conquer them. Notice, beloved, that it's not the Lamb with his mighty angels, or even the Lamb with all of his people. Just the Lamb. You say, but Ard, his people are there with him. Yes. But they are his retinue, not his resources. They represent no independent source of power because he needs none. They are simply distinguished as the called. They have been made recipients of the internal, irresistible call of God, which means they have been sovereignly chosen over against those up in verse 8. Whose names had not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And what's more, they have proved their election by being faithful to Jesus Christ and the gospel despite all the expressions of the beast's wrath. Oh yes, there are people with him, but make no mistake about it, my friends, the victory has been earned by him, by the Lamb and the Lamb alone. He's the great warrior. Notice here, Lord of lords and King of kings. In fact, it is his lordship that assures the outcome of the battle. Look at it. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. Why? For he is the Lord of lords and King of kings. His infinite supremacy is what guarantees the victory. But what we must never forget, beloved, and if you've checked out sometime prior to this, tune in now as we finish. What we must never forget is that this lordship with which he was invested took place as a consequence of his accomplishments as a lamb. Do you remember Revelation chapter 5? The Lion of the tribe of Judah has conquered. Not by his great ferocity, but by the sacrifice of his life. The Lamb will conquer. The Lamb will conquer. In principle, This final conquest of his enemies is but one part of the comprehensive victory that he had already won at the cross. The cross did it all. Everything that takes place subsequent to the cross is the outworking of what was accomplished there. That was the place of victory. That was the decisive battle, my friends. This is simply the mopping up of what was accomplished there. He conquers them as the Lamb. You see, beloved, it's just as I said to you at the beginning this morning. The cross of Jesus Christ and the Lord's Supper, which so powerfully illustrates it, by design, seeks always, always to thrust our vision forward. As we come to the table, the meal it contains not only reminds us of a past execution, it points us to a future expectation. The New Jerusalem, to be sure, but the destruction of all God's enemies prior to the New Jerusalem. If we are to resist the seductions of the whore and the terrors of the beast, we must allow the cross of Jesus Christ to refocus our attention on the future. I must tell you, friends, I came here this morning with a bit of trepidation. Because I feared that from this passage and from what we would say about it, that there might be some today who would leave saying, you know, there really wasn't much application. You want application? Get out your pencils. Here are 4 points of application. Point one, we will face the persecution of the beast. Point two, Jesus Christ will defeat the beast. Point three, the fact is, as the Lamb, he already has. Point four, so don't yield to the beast. How's that for application? It's the best I can give you. You don't need 6 steps. When you have the cross, would you bow your heads with me, please?